we have, through the National Institutes of Health, your taxpayers' dollars at work, a grant that is jointly shared between the Ann Arbor District Library and the University of Michigan, where Celeste Choate, Celeste, raise your hand, is the librarian principal investigator, and I am the principal investigator at the University of Michigan. And it's called a Partners in Research Grant, and our particular grant is about bringing information about clinical research, health information, and health education to the community in these types of events. And we've done a number of different disease-oriented and themes, and you'll see more coming up in the days to come. And then we also have focus groups and other activities that stem from this activity, where we try to learn more about what the community wants to know about clinical research. Are we doing a good job providing it? You know, what other information can we put on websites or in pamphlets or in events like this to provide you with the information that you would like to seek from us? So without further ado, I'm going to sort of take care of some of the housekeeping activities. On your seats, there should have been a form that is the data that we're collecting to be able to show the NIH that we're using their money wisely. So there's a few questions that just ask you very briefly what your knowledge or information was before hearing the event, and then answering the same questions again after the event. And it's really, really important to us that we collect this information. So if you could take a moment just now, if you haven't already, and answer the questions that are indicated as the before questions. Okay, can we pass out forms to anyone who may not have received one? Yeah, raise your hand if you don't have one. There's some extra ones. Okay, I'll ask you to raise your hands again in a moment so you don't end up getting numb wrists. Celeste went to go grab some more copies, and she'll be back. When our speakers are done speaking, we are going to open this up for discussion. And usually we have people go to the back of the room, but because we're such a full audience, when you want to ask a question, if you can raise your hand and wait for the microphone to be passed to you. We are taping this evening's event, and then the Ann Arbor District Library puts those tapes on their website for people who were not able to attend this evening so that they can watch it at their leisure. So without a microphone, we see a voice, a mouth moving, and no question on the film. So it's going to be really important. Any other logistics questions? Do we have the forms now, Celeste? No? Okay, we will in a moment. So what I'm going to do is move on to introducing our speakers this evening. We have two speakers from the Alzheimer's Association of Michigan, the Great Lakes chapter. Jennifer Howard is a social worker and is a speaker representative from the Alzheimer's Association of Michigan, and she will be our first speaker. And then Justine Glott, am I saying that right? Is the Central Regional Coordinator for the Alzheimer's Association of Michigan Great Lakes Chapter. So we're very, very pleased that the Alzheimer's Disease Association is partnering with us this evening. After those two colleagues are done with their presentations, and they're going to present sort of the basic introductory information about Alzheimer's disease, we have two faculty members from the University of Michigan. Dr. Bruno Giordani is an Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Psychology, and the director of the neuropsychology section in the University of Michigan's clinical core, and associate director of the Michigan Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. And then following Dr. Giordani, Dr. Nancy Barbas, who is an associate professor in the Department of Neurology and the director of the Cognitive Disorders Clinic at the University of Michigan Health System, will also be speaking. And when they're all concluded, we'll have a panel that will be able to then take your questions. So let me go ahead and turn this over to Jennifer.
Good evening. How are you all? Thank you for coming. I'm going to keep my little timer going here so I keep track of how long I've been speaking, because I could talk for hours tonight with you about this. Tonight, I am going to just go over sort of a brief introduction to Alzheimer's disease and talk about some other dementias and things that cause memory loss. So it's going to be sort of an introductory kind of discussion. I want to welcome you all here, whether you are just beginning your learning journey about Alzheimer's disease and dementias, or if you are a caregiver or a person with memory loss and you've been dealing with this for a number of years. I hope that you find some new things to learn about this evening. I think that we'll have a lot of great things to discuss. To begin with, I just want to give you sort of dispel some myths about Alzheimer's disease and dementia and aging, and talk about what is normal aging versus what is dementia, and when does memory loss become a problem. First of all, I think some of us have the idea that memory loss is just a normal part of aging, that when we get older, of course, we start forgetting things, and we hear terms like senior moments and old timers or senility and those types of things, like it's a normal part of our experience as we age. And so tonight I'd like to dispel that myth, because memory loss is actually not a normal part of aging. But I want you to think about how our bodies are aging, because how many of you have ever gone to your doctor and said, I'm really concerned about my brain and how my brain is aging? I think we think about, how is my brain working? I'm a little concerned about it. I don't know what to do to keep it healthy or make it healthy. I think we talk a lot about our hearts. We talk a lot about our bodies and how they're functioning. Can we walk as far as we could 10 years ago? Can we, do certain things without getting out of breath? How are our bodies changing? But how many people have had a conversation with their physician about how their brain is aging? Not probably as many conversations going that way. But remember that our brains are aging with our bodies. Our brains are just part of us. They're part of how we function, how we think. Our memory is all stored in our brains. Everything that we do in all of our experience is are housed in our brains. And so our brains are aging with us, and you would expect that as the years pass, we would have some normal age-related changes. And you do. For instance, it should take you longer as you're getting older to remember things as it used to. And I don't want anybody in this room to be panicked if you've lost your car keys twice this week and think, oh my goodness, do I have Alzheimer's disease? Am I experiencing some type of dementia? How many people have gone into the kitchen and forgotten completely standing in front of the refrigerator why you even got up and walked into the kitchen? And is that happening more often? Do you find that that's happening? I always said that after I had children, I thought that most of my brain cells went to my kids, because I found myself doing these things a lot more often than I used to when I was younger. But a lot of that is just sort of normal age-related changes. It should be a little bit more difficult for you to find words and names. If you walk up and you see a familiar face, maybe an old friend or colleague, and maybe your spouse is standing right there, and you say, oh, I'd like you to introduce you to, and all of a sudden that name is gone. You know the face, and it's just right on the tip of your tongue, but maybe a second later you get it. But it can be frustrating, and we can get worried about those kind of things. But it really should take a little bit longer. Our brains are working. They're just taking a little bit longer to recall those memories. When you learn a new thing, if you're learning how to play piano for the first time, or a card game, or maybe how to knit or some other type of activity, it might take you a little longer to pick up on that than it would when you were younger, and it should. And I think the one that gets us the most is just getting more easily distracted. I always call it seeing a pretty light off in the distance. You're doing something and then, ooh, a pretty light. You see something going on over there. And it distracts us from what we're doing. And then we come back, we can't remember what it was. And so we find ourselves misplacing things more easily, like those car keys or something else. And what's happening is that you're focused on a task, but you're just getting distracted a little more easily. It's hard to remember what you were doing in the first place. And those times can become very frustrating for all of us. But a lot of those are just normal age-related changes. And so we can take some comfort in that is sort of a normal part of our brains getting older with the rest of our bodies. Now, when does that become a problem? When should we start to worry? We should start to worry if we're experiencing memory loss that is interfering with what we normally do every day. If you are the person in your household who balances the checkbook and has always taken care of the bills, and you're having a really hard time doing that now, maybe the bills aren't getting paid, maybe you're finding you're getting overdrafts every month and you're not sure how that's happening, you might want to take a step back and just say, what's going on? Am I having a harder time, doing this? things that you are familiar with, that you've done your entire life, if those things are becoming more difficult for you to do, then you might want to think about, you know, what is it about it that is more difficult? When people are experiencing dementia as opposed to just normal age-related changes, you might the memory lapses that we were talking about, all those little frustrating things, don't just happen once in a while. They might be happening a lot, I mean, to the point where it's really frustrating and really not only concerning you but maybe concerning your loved ones, too, that are with you every day. And also, in the earlier stages of some types of dementia, people can experience personality changes and getting lost in familiar places, that type of thing. You know, roads that you've driven your entire life, suddenly having no idea, you know, where you are, how to get home, those types of things. These are just some red flags. But there's no, you know, definite way that I can tell you, you know, tonight you have dementia or this is just normal age-related changes that you're experiencing. But there is a difference. You should be seeing changes, but it shouldn't interfere with your everyday life to the point where it's really concerning or concerning your loved ones. So if you're worried, what you want to do is you want to talk to your doctor and maybe seek some help and learn what you can. So we'll talk a little bit more about how to do that. So what is dementia? Dementia is a term that's thrown around a lot, and it is sort of an overall, what we call umbrella term, for a lot of different things. Dementia isn't a specific illness. Dementia is more, I think of it more as a symptom. Dementia simply, in layman's terms, means memory loss. You're experiencing memory loss. And I've had caregivers come to me before and say, I'm really concerned. My father was just diagnosed with dementia. And my first question is always, okay, I know he's experiencing memory loss, but what kind of dementia? What's causing the memory loss? What's causing the dementia? So let's get those terms cleared up tonight. Dementia is simply a loss of cognitive or intellectual functioning, such as thinking, remembering, reasoning, that it's so severe it's starting to interfere with that person's life. It's starting to interfere with your loved one or your ability, whoever's experiencing the memory loss, your ability to carry out just normal day-to-day living. It's getting in the way of something. So if we know that this memory loss is happening, our next question and what we really want to figure out is what's causing the memory loss. So again, a little bit more about dementia. It's memory loss, but it also might be a loss of the ability to use language, especially when it comes to Alzheimer's disease. We find that the part of the brain that Alzheimer's disease attacks at first is not only short-term memory or recent memories, but the ability to use language. And so that's when we find people are having a hard time finding words. Just a normal conversation, just, you know, not just like a name of a person or something like the name of a specific town or something like that, but just a normal word that they would use every single day, they might have a hard time finding that word, and they might also have some problems understanding the words that they're hearing. So language ability can often be affected. Disorientation, not only to place, we talked about getting lost, but it might be to time of day or just location, that type of thing. So just a general disorientation, ability to do calculations, and we talked about familiar tasks. A person's judgment can be impaired also in the earlier stages of dementia, doing things that may not have been the best decision for them. And it could be maybe, you know, somebody calls on the phone and solicits money from them, and maybe normally they would say, you know what, this sounds like a scam, but because their judgment is impaired, maybe they say, okay, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Let me give you my credit card number. That might be an example of poor judgment. Or maybe just in the sense of dressing in short-sleeve shirts and it's 50 degrees outside, it's just too chilly. Just not, you know, using the judgment to dress warmly on a cool day. It could be a number of different things. Thinking abstractly can be impaired. It can be very difficult to think sort of on an abstract level. And then again, changes in behavior or personality. And I think that sometimes loved ones can pick up on those subtle changes even better than a person who's experiencing memory loss. When somebody just reacts different emotionally to a situation than they normally would, you know, on any given day. We all have our bad days, that's for sure. So I'm not saying that if you're having a bad day, that's dementia. I'm just saying that, you know, on a regular basis, maybe somebody's just not acting the same way that they normally would. So why do we want to, what's treatable and what is not treatable as far as dementia? Why do we want to figure out what's going on? So we know that somebody's experiencing memory loss. We want to talk about why figuring out what's causing the memory loss is so critical and so important. One of the reasons is because a lot of things that cause memory loss are completely treatable and curable. They can be very simple things. And all the list up on your left are examples of those. Things like medications. There might be medication interactions, or maybe the medications are too strong for the person. We know that medications in an older adult body react very differently than the same medications being prescribed to somebody who is much younger. So maybe those medications are just too strong. Maybe they're interacting with each other, but it's causing confusion. It's causing what looks like memory loss. A major symptom of depression is memory loss, and somebody might be experiencing a major depressive episode. Maybe they are experiencing depression. That can cause lack of concentration, cause people to have a really hard time to remember things that they're learning. Dehydration, electrolyte balance, vitamin deficiencies, urinary tract infection can be a major cause of confusion with people, especially sometimes with older adults. If you see a major change where somebody is very suddenly confused, we always want to check for infection. Normal pressure, hydrocephalus, a very treatable but concerning condition where there's pressure on the brain with extra fluid, liver or kidney disease. So we want to check. The first thing that we want to do is we want to go to a physician and say, could any of these things be causing the memory loss that we're seeing? Now, some of the irreversible causes, Alzheimer's disease being the most common irreversible cause of dementia, there are a number of other ones listed there that you might recognize, which I'm not going to go into detail this evening. But we will focus on Alzheimer's disease, as it is the most common form of an irreversible type of dementia. These are all diseases of the brain. These are all things that are causing a deterioration of the brain, and they are all, they get worse over time, and they all have different implications. But we're going to focus mostly tonight on Alzheimer's disease. So it's not to say that a person couldn't have Alzheimer's disease and also be experiencing one of these other treatable kinds of dementias. So the really important thing is to make sure to get a clear diagnosis of what's going on, and I'll explain about how to do that. But somebody might have Alzheimer's disease, they might also be experiencing depression. And maybe with treatment through counseling and medication, some of those symptoms that you're experiencing or that your loved one is experiencing might be lightened, or they might seem a little better. We might be able to take some of those symptoms and make them a little bit better. So we want to make sure that we're pulling all of these treatable causes out, make sure that they're getting treated, that they're being addressed. So again, why get a diagnosis? Why go through the process of a diagnosis? Because dementia, again, could be reversed. It could be a curable thing that you're experiencing or your loved one is experiencing. If we can cure it, let's cure it. Reversible conditions, if you leave them untreated, it could cause permanent damage. So we want to make sure that we're treating anything that we can. There are also medications that are used to treat Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. We want to try to use those as soon as we can. Early diagnosis, if it is Alzheimer's disease or other types of dementias, as a person experiencing memory loss or as a caregiver or as a loved one, you want to know what you're dealing with, because the implications can be very different depending on what it is you're dealing with. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But Alzheimer's disease is going to look very different than, say, frontal lobe dementia or Parkinson's disease or Huntington's disease or something else that might be going on. Some of these diseases last a very, very long time, and people can live with them for a very long time. And some of these diseases progress more rapidly. These all have implications for how you're going to plan for the future, as far as how are you going to plan for care, how much money is this going to cost. There are financial implications. There are legal implications as far as being a caregiver and making sure that you can care for your loved one when that person can no longer make decisions for themselves. So we want to make sure that we've got all of those things in place. And if we know what we're dealing with, then we're armed with the knowledge to plan for the future. We might have a clearer picture on what the future is going to look like. And then, of course, just establishing a family history, knowing what's going on. I don't know, you can ask yourself how many people in the audience suspects that maybe a past generation, a grandparent or a grandparent, might have experienced Alzheimer's disease. I think that there might be people in my family who have. However, no one in my family ever had a proper diagnosis. There was a lot of talk about senility or different things, but there were a lot of myths in the past about how some of these things were just a normal part of aging. So I'm not sure that a lot of people received proper diagnosis, proper care. And it's hard to establish a family history and to know genetically what's happening in your family if you don't know what it is. So just another really good reason. When you get a diagnosis for Alzheimer's disease or any other type of dementia, it's not a simple process. It's well worth it, but you will not see just one doctor, or you going to your family physician isn't going to get a proper diagnosis. There will be several different people that you will see, and it won't be a one-time visit. It's usually something that will take a little while and will require several visits, because you will probably see during the diagnostic process a family physician or a general practitioner, maybe a geriatric physician, who is going to do blood work, do urine work, test all of those things and try to rule out all of those treatable causes of dementias that we talked about. You will probably see a neurologist. You will probably see a psychologist or somebody else who will administer pen and paper testing just to figure out how your brain is working right now and how your memory is working. So some of the things that you might experience, just a complete medical history and exam, mental status exam. I don't know how many of you have been to the doctor and they've asked you questions like, do you know what floor you're on? Do you know what building you're in? Do you know what year it is? Do you know who the president is? These are types of questions that you might have been asked at a normal doctor's appointment that would be part of a mental status exam, just sort of checking in with you. Of course, a physical exam, and then neurological testing that you will receive brain imaging just to rule out things like stroke activity, brain tumor, and the things that we can see with brain scans. We want to rule all of those things out and treat them if we find anything. Laboratory tests, brain imaging we mentioned, and then the psychiatric or psychological exams. By doing those exams, they can be long and they can be a little exhausting, but it gives the people treating you or testing you a good idea of how your brain is working. What kind of things are you remembering? What kind of things are you not remembering? Because there are some general patterns, especially with Alzheimer's disease, of how the disease progresses through the brain. So it will give them a clearer picture. And usually, if you go through all of these things, and this seems to change all the time when I look it up, but within an above 95% range, usually we can get a clear diagnosis of what's going on, or at least a pretty good indication of what's going on. There is, and you may have heard, no 100% diagnosis for Alzheimer's disease except upon autopsy. But doctors can get it pretty close, and if people do know, you know, get that diagnosis, then they can go ahead with treatments. So Alzheimer's disease is, like I said, the most common form of dementia of all the irreversible types of dementia. Currently, there are about 5.3 million United States citizens with Alzheimer's disease. So Alzheimer's disease is a progressive disease, meaning it gets worse over time. It doesn't get better, even though people tend to go back and forth sometimes. Over time, it does gradually get worse. It attacks the brain cells and eventually causes brain cell death and impaired memory, thinking, and behavior. So it's a disease that is usually pretty slow in progressing, and people normally start to notice some changes, and then when the changes, the memory loss gets bad enough, they will go for diagnosis. Usually after diagnosis, someone can live with Alzheimer's disease anywhere from 3 to 20 years with the disease. And I think the average lifespan is about 4 to 6 years after diagnosis, but I have known many people who've lived with this for a very long time. I've got a very good friend whose mother lived with this for more than 20 years after diagnosis. And so when you're thinking about future planning in caring for someone with this disease, it really can. People can live with this for a very, very long time. And so we need to think about that when planning for care. So what are the risk factors? And are you worried about getting this disease yourself? If you have a mother or a father with the disease or a grandparent with this disease, does that mean that you're going to get it? And the answer is no. It doesn't mean that you definitely will get it, though genetics and family history do play in to account. The number one risk factor, with what we know today for developing Alzheimer's disease, is simply how long you live. So we know that for people over 65 years or age or more, about one in, this has changed, I think it's one in eight people over the age of 65 have Alzheimer's disease, and that gets higher as you get older. If you are 85 years of age or older, it's about half. So it's about 50% of those 85 or older who have this disease. There is what's called early stage onset Alzheimer's disease, and so people under the age of 65, there are about 200,000 cases in the United States because people can develop Alzheimer's disease early in their life, even in their 30s or 40s or 50s. The disease process usually looks a little different when people develop it earlier. It is usually seems to be a little bit more aggressive, and there seems to be a very strong genetic link to getting this disease earlier as opposed to getting it later. So genetics, we talked about lifestyle choices. We have found that the healthier that you keep your bodies, usually the healthier your brain is going to be. And so there has been a lot of research that's come out lately, and we've been advocating for people to be very proactive in taking care of their brains. There are things that you can do. And the basic premise of it is that the healthier your heart is, all those good things you do to take care of your heart as far as keeping your blood sugar levels under control, keeping your cholesterol in check, making sure that your blood pressure is at a good level, all of those things that you do that are good for your heart are also good for your brain. So we do have a lot of information, and we do try to get out and talk to people about taking care of themselves physically, staying physically active, challenging their brains, learning new things. All of these things are good for your brain. So when we talk about lifestyle choices, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about keeping your weight under control and doing all of those really healthy things for your body, because all of those things are really good for your brain too. Controversial risk factors. There have been so many times that I've heard from friends and family who've emailed me that we've found a cure for Alzheimer's disease. And, you know, how many of you have heard on the radio or heard from a friend, I think they found a cure for Alzheimer's disease. They found a link. They found a cure. It's happened to me a number of times because people know that I work in this area. But we do not have a cure for Alzheimer's disease at this time. We have treatment, but there is no cure at this time. There have been some things that people have brought up in the past. In the 70s and 80s, people talked about aluminum levels in your brain, and that if you had metal fillings and you used aluminum pans and you used aluminum foil and things like that, that could be bad for your brain, and it caused Alzheimer's disease. And we've never found anything on a research level that links aluminum to causing Alzheimer's disease. But there have been those things that have been out in the past, and you may have heard those. We do not know what causes Alzheimer's disease at this time. We do know some risk factors, but we do not know what causes it. So the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease can range from a number of things, and it looks different. Alzheimer's disease looks different for everybody who has it. And some of the things that you see up here can be in the much later stages of Alzheimer's disease. But generally speaking, in the beginning of the disease, in the early stages of the disease, we normally see changes in short-term memory loss. So people tend to remember things that happened in their past a lot better than they remember things that just happened. So they might have no idea what they had for lunch today, but they might remember the day they got married like it happened yesterday. Or they might remember their school-aged years, but they can't remember things that happened 5 years ago. And so short-term memory is always one of the things affected first. And then we talked about use of language. That's another symptom that happens early, where people have a hard time finding words and start to have problems with communication early. As the disease progresses, and I'm going to talk about stages, the forgetfulness usually gets worse, and people start to need supervision. So they might forget things, not just what they had for lunch or who they saw yesterday at the store, but they might forget things like taking medications, or they might forget to eat breakfast in the morning, and things that really affect how a person's health is going to be. So eventually, towards the middle stages of the disease, people will need supervision. A lot of the things that you see on here, and I don't want you to be alarmed, these are things that people can experience as the disease progresses through its later stage. Alzheimer's disease starts at a certain area of the brain, progresses throughout the entire brain. And so let's move on for just a second. We see just a picture of the brain here. And we see the area of the brain here, the temporal lobe, that controls things like behavior, memory, emotion, which is usually the part that is affected in the early stages. But the cerebral cortex, the largest part of the brain, there are several different lobes, but control in general, everything that we use in terms of thinking, reasoning, our ability to go through our day-to-day activities, all of our memories and our emotions are stored in this part of the brain. It really is how we function and who we are every day. So different parts of the brain, like the cerebellum, control balance and coordination. It's my ability to stand here at the podium and to stay balanced and to not fall over. It's my ability to walk from this end of the room to the other end of the room if I want to, and to navigate my space. And then the brainstem controls all the things that we don't think about, like our heart beating, swallowing, all of those types of things, breathing. And so all three main areas of the brain will eventually be affected by the disease. Alzheimer's disease is a fatal disease that will eventually take a person's life if nothing does beforehand. A lot of people, as I said, can live with this disease for many, many years. And so if they have other physical issues going on, like heart disease, cancer, anything else, they might lose their life before this disease ever takes hold, especially if it starts later in life. So just something to keep in mind. But as the disease, as we can see, progresses, things like our senses, our ability to see things and understand what we're seeing, everything that we hear, everything that we smell, all of that input that we're getting is compromised. And so when you see things on the board before, like we saw about hallucinations, visual hearing disturbances, all of those types of things, those can be affected, and usually in the later stages of the disease. In the later stages, people also will definitely need 24-hour supervision and eventually will need help with all of their normal activities of daily living, like getting dressed, bathing, eating, and those types of things. So it is a tremendously devastating disease to a person. So due to time concerns, I think I'm going to fly through a lot of these a little quickly, but just in general, so you know what Alzheimer's disease is doing, we have millions of neurons or brain cells in our brain that are communicating with each other constantly. Those neurons are connected and form billions of connections in our brain. Those connections are really important because our brain cells need to communicate with each other for us to function, for us to think normally. Alzheimer's disease compromises those connections, so the neurons are not talking to each other, they're not communicating. The chemicals that pass between the neurons, called neurotransmitters, are not able to do what they need to do. And so we see things like plaques and tangles, which you might have heard about in the past, that get in the way of the neurons talking to each other. Eventually, this causes the cells to die away, and they literally die, and they literally shrink. And so we see atrophy, or the shrinkage of the brain, as the disease progresses. And we see here on the top slide, this is upon autopsy, the brain of a normal elderly person without Alzheimer's disease. We can see the devastation on the bottom slides of a person with Alzheimer's disease upon autopsy. And you can see how the brain has physically shrunk and how it has shrunk in on itself as the cells have been dying away. And so you can see sort of in a very visual term what the disease is doing to the brain and how the brain cells are dying away. There is hope, and there are medications that help treat the disease. There are five that have been approved for treatment of Alzheimer's disease, which are listed above. Cognex, Aricept, Exelon, Razadine, and Namenda. Namenda is in a completely different class of medications as the top four, and so sometimes doctors will prescribe Namenda in conjunction with Aricept or Exelon or one of the medications from the top drug family, so you might see some of those. In general, these medications are designed to slow the progression of the disease. They do not cure the disease, but the hope is that if you prescribe the medications, that the decline of functioning might happen slower than it would have if you had not introduced these medications. In general, we say that the medications can help a person and slow the progression 6 to 12 months, and usually works for about half the people that they're prescribed for. It is definitely worth trying. So we talked about the stages a little bit, and I'm not going to go into them in too much, but you might hear things like early, middle, later stages of the disease, and I want to tell you that nobody fits neatly into any one of these. So if you or a loved one has Alzheimer's disease, nobody is going to be able to tell you definitively your loved one is in the middle stages of Alzheimer's disease. They might have some symptoms that are, most symptoms that are in the middle, but maybe some of the symptoms are more severe and look like they are in the later stages of the disease. Some of the things like incontinence or inability to recognize loved ones or themselves, some things like that. But maybe they're very functional and maybe some of their symptoms look like they're in the earlier stages. In general, though, I want you to know that in the early stages of the disease, people are usually very functional and can do many things on their own, sometimes with just a little help, sometimes with just friendly reminders. And so in the earlier stages of the disease, this is an amazing time to sit down with loved ones, whether you have Alzheimer's disease or another type of dementia or your family member does, and this is a great time to work on planning for the future and talking about what this might look like in the days to come. Doing legal and financial planning is a really great time. And for the person with Alzheimer's disease, this is a really amazing time to have a voice and to say what they want, maybe what they don't want as time progresses. Because in the middle to later stages, this will become more difficult. So also in the middle to later stages, people do still have many, many usually wonderful years and a lot of wonderful experiences just to share with each other. But knowing that planning happens a little better in the earlier stages, just keep that in mind. And so, you know, we talk about the feelings that people with Alzheimer's disease may feel, and we always used to talk about, you know, just what the person with Alzheimer's disease might feel. We talk about grief and anger, and a lot of these, you know, the anger, the guilt, feelings of inadequacy, apprehension about the future and the days to come, a lot of these are normal feelings that anybody would feel who is grieving, the sort of normal emotions that you might feel upon grieving the loss of someone or the loss of certain things. We added to it, caregivers might also feel this because caregivers are also going through a lot of the same feelings, and especially with the person with Alzheimer's disease in the earlier stages, when they understand what's happening and they understand what's coming in the future, they can experience intense feelings of apprehension. So this is just a cute little cartoon. There's a woman standing there talking to a person who's caring for her, and it says, "Honey, I've been through two world wars, the Great Depression, taught 3,297 children, administered four elementary schools, and outlived every one of the pastors I've worked with. I'm 89 years old, and you're telling me it's bedtime." And the reason we put this up there is just to emphasize again that people need to be a part of the decision-making process for themselves because it's their lives and they have opinions. And just because a person is experiencing memory loss doesn't mean that they cannot be an amazing part of the planning and in everything in the caretaking as well. And so you want to have those conversations and keep people as involved as possible throughout, not just the early stages, but every stage of the disease. And this is another quote from somebody who wrote a book, Robert Davis, My Journey into Alzheimer's Disease. It says, "In my present condition, there are times I still feel normal. At other times, I cannot follow what is going on around me. As the conversation whips too fast from person to person, and before I've processed one comment, the thread has moved to another person or another topic, and I'm left isolated from the action, alone in the crowd. If I press myself with greatest concentration to keep up, I feel as though something short circuits in my brain." So he's speaking from sort of an earlier stage of the disease where he's still very much a part of conversations in his loved ones' lives, but it's very hard to process all of that information and to have all of these conversations going on around him. And so he's feeling that apprehension. He's feeling, you know, sort of that anxiety. Nobody who is experiencing this disease or caring for somebody with this disease can do this alone, and there are a number of community supports and just supports from family and friends out there. I always tell people you can't do this alone. It's exhausting, and nobody can care for themselves. Nobody can care for a loved one all by themselves. They need help. Respite care, we talk about which is just a brief break from caregiving, just a chance to get out and do something that has nothing to do with caregiving. And there are many different ways that you can do this, whether you have a friend come in and stay with your loved one if you're a caregiver, or maybe it might be an adult day program. There are great adult day programs out there, especially in the Ann Arbor area, where a person with dementia can go and do fun activities with other people, and their loved ones can go and do something that doesn't have to do with caregiving. It's a really great break. There is home health care available. Residential care are things like nursing home care or assisted living. Adult foster care, there are a number of different residential cares. When caring for someone at home just becomes something that's not possible. And then palliative care is just comfort care, especially towards the end stages of the disease. So having said that, I am going to now turn it over to Justine Gallat, who's going to talk to you just a little bit. I don't want to leave you hanging tonight. There is so much information out there, and she's going to let you know how to get some more of that information through the Alzheimer's Association.
Good evening. As Jen said, I'm Justine Gallat. I'm the regional coordinator at the Michigan Great Lakes Chapter South Central Region. And I'm going to make my part short and sweet so you can get to more information that will help you dealing with Alzheimer's. And everything I'm going to say you can find on our website as well. So we have a number of support groups that we offer. They meet once a month. I have a listing of all of them outside on our table, and they are free, and you do not have to RSVP. You may just feel free to show up. We have our helpline that is 24/7. The phone number is up here on the screen, and you can call for resources, for care consultation, for advice, and it goes to the local chapter from whatever area code you are calling from. And this is a nationwide service. Care consultations, we have a social worker on staff that can meet with you individually, in person, or just on the phone, and provide you with some social work services. And we have a number of educational programs, and I also have the flyer out front. These are free to the community. We can also schedule programs to take place at your church or your service group if you'd like. And we have our Memory Walk season upon us, and those are our biggest fundraisers coming up. And I have a flyer also out front that lists all of our Memory Walks that take place throughout the community. And October 1st, Sunday, October 1st at Huron Woods on St. Joe's campus will be our Ann Arbor Memory Walk. And you are all welcome to participate in the walk or volunteer or donate. It is a fun time, and we have a Barry Manilow impersonator coming. And it's a really, and his mother actually passed away from Alzheimer's. He was her caregiver for many years. And we have our Safe Return program, and I have a sample of that out on the table too. It is a program in partnership with Medic Alert and the Alzheimer's Association. Persons with Alzheimer's can wear a pendant or a bracelet, and it identifies who to call should this person wander away from their home or from their facility or wherever they happen to be living. And it's a nationwide program. It is a way to help ensure safety for those who are wandering. So like I said, I'll keep mine short and sweet. I'll be available afterwards at my table out front if you have any questions about our services. And I encourage you to use our services. We are there for you. Thank you.
So hello, everybody. I'm Bruno Giordani. That's what the slide says, and I keep that to remind me each time in case I get confused. But you'll notice that I'm wearing my Michigan pin, since I'm on the faculty at University of Michigan, and because I do a lot of work with the Alzheimer's Association, I have my Alzheimer's purple, so I match the slides before. And it's probably a good thing. It's a lot easier to find purple shirts nowadays. This one took me a couple years to find originally. Oh, I'm sorry. What do I do? Short people need... So... What I was asked to talk about is a little bit about advances in Alzheimer's disease research going on now, some of the things at the University of Michigan, some of the things we're doing in general, as well as the things that are linked to our Alzheimer's Disease Research Center here. Our Alzheimer's Disease Research Center has been funded by the government. Now we're passing through our 20th year of funding here, and we have a new, what we call competing renewal in, so we're all kind of praying that we get 5 more years. It comes in 5-year slots. So hopefully that will turn out well for us. I think, let me start first just telling you a little bit of what's happened over the past 25 or more years. What are some of the changes since the Alzheimer's centers began in this era? First of all, in 1983, NIH spent $22 million on Alzheimer's disease research, and now it's spending about $640 million annually. It's a huge difference. I won't talk about inflation, but there's no Alzheimer's disease research structure. There was no real infrastructure in 1983, and now there are 29 funded programs, and I'll talk a little bit more about those in a moment, but there are now 29 centers of excellence around the country to study specifically Alzheimer's disease. So there's a linked network around the country now of centers. In 83, there were 269 articles on Alzheimer's disease up to 1983, and since then there have been 3,365, and really even more than that related to dementia and Alzheimer's. So there's been a huge burst of interest in this area, and that's very important. Diagnosis really was uncertain in 1983. In 1983, I was at Mount Sinai in New York, and our diagnostic accuracy, we felt, was very poor in terms of trying to really understand what was going on. And the diagnostic accuracy now is better than 90%. There were no prescription medicines in 1983. We didn't know what to do. Now there are 5 medications approved, and you'll hear tonight about a lot of really exciting and novel ways of looking at medications that are being developed. So there's been a lot of change in this time. And actually, it's interesting that this change has all been going on, because if you think about it, Alzheimer's disease is actually a very, very small part of the federal budget, very small part of research. You can see that cancer is a huge chunk, which is why we've had so many advances there, HIV/AIDS, cardiovascular research, and there's Alzheimer's right up there. As a matter of fact, we hoped in 2007 to get a much bigger bolus, but it didn't really come through because of budget and other issues. But some folks say that senators and congressmen don't like voting for things that might relate in some way to their brain. But I don't like to get into that one. But so let me explain a little bit about what the National Institute of Aging has funded. Because of the concern about there isn't a lot of funding, there isn't as big a piece of the budget, even though Alzheimer's disease, as you've already heard, is going to be a marked, significant problem, especially by the year 2050. This will really, literally, by 2050, Alzheimer's disease will break the Medicare and Medicaid banks. We don't have to worry about inflation or other things just because of the marked, significant, with the aging population, the significant change in these needs. So one of the things the National Institute of Aging said is, because we have limited dollars, we will establish a set of research centers that will be all linked together, and there are now 29 of those. We were part of the original couple that were sets that were developed. But these are centers that will serve as a resource to the community by providing information and education on aging, Alzheimer's disease, and related disorders, and also provide a resource to young investigators. So the idea is these would be Alzheimer's disease centers that would be funded to really foster research, foster understanding, and in our case, we're one of the set that also have our own dedicated research components. We're an ADRC, an Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. But these are centers across the country. We're the only real Midwest one. There are 2 in Chicago, but we're the only one in this area. But we communicate with all these other centers. We meet twice a year. We all share research data. So everyone in our studies, that data is available to all the other centers. There's somebody in our group, for example, that's doing a very large research study based on all the data from all the different centers. So these are all really interesting. These linkages are finally beginning to pay off. These are some of the research directions that we have here based on what the National Institute of Aging has asked us to do and what some of our researchers in the area are doing, but it gives you sort of a flavor for what's going on. A lot of our research is an attempt to understand what happens as we get older and what happens as our memory changes. We also want to understand what occurs within the brain before you really can say this is Alzheimer's disease or what's going on. What are some of the earliest brain changes that may be markers of things to come? We're trying to research better diagnostic methods to differentiate between different types of dementia so that if somebody comes in with problems very early on, what can we say about this? How can we diagnose early so we can make the best impact? We're also interested in looking at the safety and the effectiveness of brand new medications and treatments, and Dr. Barbas will talk about that after I'm done, because I mean this is a really exciting area, what's really happening now that we understand so much more now about how Alzheimer's disease develops and how it changes over time and how we can interfere very early in that process. It's critically important. We're also interested in things that try and increase research participation, because one of the difficulties we have in Alzheimer's disease often is it's hard to get people to participate. Nobody likes to come into my office and have me ask them to remember 15 different animals. It's just not a lot of fun, and it's difficult. And because of our interest now really is much more on very early problems, it means people are working, they can't come in, there are all these different things. So we have a number of different studies even looking at that. We look at testings that we can do in people's homes, we look at interactions with the computer or on the telephone, a lot of these different ways of trying to say, okay, if we're going to do research or if we're going to look at effectiveness of medicines, let's try and do it in people's homes so that they don't have to keep coming in and seeing me. Different ways of doing things, so we're very interested in that. We also are very interested now in doing research in novel things we can do, what really the things that you and I can do to reduce our risks of Alzheimer's disease. There are medications that are coming down the pike. Questions about how effective the medications are we have now in terms of maybe symptoms but not changing the disease, but what can we actually do as individuals to potentially change our risk of developing Alzheimer's disease? These are really important things. I also want to tell you all that it's amazing that I've sat here this long. I usually, you'll see me trying to move, but I'm trying to stay with the microphone. Types of studies that we do at our Alzheimer's disease really run the gamut of studies done across the country. There are a number of studies we're doing looking at animal research. Now there's actually an animal model of Alzheimer's disease where you can actually see plaques, other amyloid deposits, other things that are related to Alzheimer's disease in an actual animal model, which is critical because animals have a shorter lifespan. We can look at new medications in them. So this research is really absolutely critical that's going on around the country. Brain imaging studies. We do quite a bit of research here on imaging studies. This is a PET scan. I don't know how many people here have had an MRI scan or a CT scan before, but that shows you the structure of the brain. What the PET scan does is it actually shows you what's going on in the brain. It actually shows you how the brain is using glucose or sugar or energy metabolism, and you can see how different parts of the brain light up and use that energy compared to others. In Alzheimer's disease, these more parietal temporal, these more posterior areas of the brain actually use much less energy than other areas. So we can begin to understand where these difficulties are starting. So imaging studies are important. Clinical trials are important. Medication studies that Dr. Barbas and Dr. Heidebrink do in our group are critically important for this work. Other sorts of clinical trials, just looking at changes in memory and things over time. All of these are interesting studies, or observational studies. This guy here, his kids think he really developed his problems when he was about 30, but I try and... One of the main studies we're doing here is a study that's done across all 29 sites, all 29 Alzheimer's Disease Center studies, which is really basically simply an observational study. We follow people on a yearly basis. We do a medical evaluation, a neurological evaluation, we do some memory testing, and we just follow people over time, people who are healthy, people with mild problems, and just follow over time to look and see if we can understand what's happening in this course. Because we know that normal aging, eventually something happens in the brain which eventually shows signs, and some people call mild cognitive impairment or MCI, which is sort of a prodromal or an early stage that could develop into Alzheimer's disease. But what we know, which is true for all these things, and I have down here, is protecting a healthy brain makes much more sense than trying to fix a broken one. So a lot of the research now, really the majority of research, is trying to understand this zone up here. And the only way we can really understand that is following people over time, looking at our imaging studies, looking at our different memory studies, to see what happens in this early period, to see what happens if we intervene with new medications and other things. That's why there's been this whole shift of interest in looking at this as early as possible, so that we can intervene as early as possible. We also do... One of our primary projects right now is a project looking at animal studies where we're interested in the issue of beta amyloid and tau. These are the things that are related to the plaques and tangles that occur in the brain. This is the hallmark of Alzheimer's disease. And Dr. Barbas will talk a little bit more about that, I'm sure. But this is all part of our understanding for what happens, why these plaques develop in the brain and basically clog up the brain's ability to communicate with it, with all the different neurons to communicate, as well as essentially actually bumping into the cell membrane sometimes and causing damage. We also know tau, which may or may not be a little bit further down the pike, which really breaks the cells down, breaks those neural bodies down so that they can't communicate effectively. So a lot of the animal research is trying to understand these things in its earliest stages. We are very interested in Michigan at doing imaging studies. There is a fascinating change over the past few years in the way we can do imaging, so that we can now look at amyloid in the brain, that precursor to the brain of Alzheimer's disease. We can actually see where these areas are in the brain where amyloid, where plaques first begin to occur. So, for example, this is an individual without Alzheimer's disease, and you can see the plaques light up a little bit. The more red, the more yellow it is, the more there is. But this is sort of a normal distribution that we get. But then you can see a patient with Alzheimer's disease, really in these parietal temporal areas, in these frontal areas of the brain, there are clear designations of plaque. We just didn't have this ability a few years ago to be able to do this, where we can really look at this disorder very early on and see what's going on. Another interest of ours is really trying to understand the earliest diagnostic process so that if somebody comes in with a memory problem, what can we say to that person in terms of, well, we think this would be a direction to go with medication. We think this would be a direction to go. We think this is what's going to happen over time. This is a critical thing because as we try to diagnose as early as possible, we need to know what are the diagnostic signs. So we have a lot of interest now in looking at different types of scans. This is a type of PET scanning, which essentially this is looking at glucose metabolism in the brain and comparing a patient's brain to a large group of healthy brains to try and say what area is different. So this type of scan essentially is a scan that tells you what's different. So for example, in Alzheimer's disease, you can see this parietal temporal and these frontal areas of the brain. The brighter it is, the more different it is from normal, and you can see what really starts to be a very classic picture. The motor areas of the brain, the areas that involve walking and movement are not affected, but the areas of the brain that involve memory, the areas of the brain that involve judgment are clearly affected in this disorder. But then if we look at people with very mild problems, we still begin to see that same ghost of a change. So these kind of new techniques to be able to look at things as early as possible really are critical and also help us differentiate different types of disorders. Frontal temporal dementia, which is really a dementia that affects only the front part of the brain, which leads to behavioral difficulties and a different, very different pattern, often in younger individuals than is Alzheimer's disease or may develop early. All of these techniques now allow us to begin to look at where these changes are compared to normal. Multi-infarct dementia, normal pressure hydrocephalus, Lewy body dementia, which is a type of dementia associated with Parkinson's disease in many ways. And what you can see there is a characteristic picture, for example, of in the occipital lobe, the back of the brain involved in vision and things like that. There's a big difference back here that's sort of characteristic of Parkinson's, which in Alzheimer's disease doesn't really occur. So again, we're beginning to be able to do much more in terms of diagnostic differences. It's really important for us, again, to be able to diagnose early so we can have some effectiveness. At the Alzheimer's Center, besides those core projects I just mentioned to you, which are core projects, we have a number of other studies going on that we support from other investigators throughout campus. We're very interested in movement and motor because we know that patients with Alzheimer's disease and even all of us as we get older are much more prone to falls and the risk of falls. And falls have a dramatic effect as we get older. So we're very interested in techniques that allow us to improve falls. Tai Chi, teaching balance. These are critical types of skills as we get older. So we're interested in how people step accurately, how they move accurately. These different types of movement studies are very interesting. The MCASL, there's a very large automobile and safety study group here that is really interested in changes that occur as we get older in our ability to drive. It used to be years ago, most of those studies were done with you sitting in front of a big giant television screen and you sort of sat in a pretend car and drove and different things happened on the screen, which was very interesting, although people tend to get a little sick because they're not moving, but the whole surround. So I don't know if anybody's ever done that in this audience, but it's quite a startle. But now what we can do, or what they can do actually, is take someone's car and make it into a little robot, basically, where it has GPS, it has radar, it has sonar, and you can actually get a picture of where somebody drives in the United States and how they drive. And we can begin to look at changes now in how people make decisions about their driving. So it's a fascinating work. I always kind of mention this study because these are some of my favorite studies. There are new medication studies, and Dr. Barbas is doing a number of different studies in that as are other individuals. But this is one of the studies that we may be starting at some point, which is a study on resveratrol, which is something found commonly. I always bring this one up, but something found commonly in red grapes, red wine. So it's some people have associated this with the Mediterranean diet and perhaps why among Mediterranean countries there's a lower level of Alzheimer's disease, so it's building a lot of interest. That's why some people have suggested that a glass or two a day or a glass or two sort of in a week is perfectly appropriate. I can tell you, though, if you want about the same equivalent as resveratrol as a pill, you've got to go a couple cases a night. And I really don't recommend that for other reasons. You may be very happy, but it won't last very long. But again, these are all novel techniques and novel approaches to medication. We have other factors that we're looking at, again, that were already mentioned earlier, but some of the really interesting ways we have now to say, what can you do about your health to lower your risk? Because medications aren't sort of popping up and appearing quickly. There's a lot of research yet to be done. So partially, we're very interested. We have a couple studies now starting on exercise, the importance of aerobic exercise. Now a few studies have come out suggesting it's amazingly important. Mental activity, keeping your mind alert. Don't tell your 14-year-olds, but playing video games actually can be very helpful to you. So that idea of engaging the brain actually shows significant changes. So there's more and more interest in looking at different types of computer gaming and different types of memory training and things. Diet was already mentioned. Diet is critical. The whole issue of the Mediterranean diet, the potential changes that diet may have in keeping us healthy. Socialization, that piece that for a long time nobody was really paying attention to, that we now know is critically important from a number of studies that have been done, for example, with the nuns studies, the retirement studies, where we've looked at those issues, other researchers have looked at those issues of socialization and the importance of interacting with others. Those are critically important for memory and critically important for those areas. I just want to mention before I end about a whole range of things coming up here. And one of them is our community appreciation conference that we have every year. And this year we're really particularly interested in looking at medication changes and what's on that pike, but then at the same time looking at those other approaches that are of real interest now. So exercise and diet. These are critical things. And Cassie Starbuck, our education coordinator, who's back there somewhere. There's Cassie. Cassie told me today we have a great Mediterranean diet provided. And Cassie knows that's the best way to get me to go somewhere is to actually feed me. So Cassie's done real well at that. But this is a very interesting conference. We have other brochures. This is Dr. Gilman, our director, very distinguished looking. And this is a brochure you can take about our research things. I just want to mention a few things because there are some great things out there from the Alzheimer's Association. The Engage folks have a great little thing here that talks about walking for health and the importance of cognition and diet and things like that. There's our conference. Coming up on October 11th and the 15th is a fascinating movie called You Are Here that's going to be at Quality 16 Theaters, where popcorn is only 25 cents for a refill. So it's but at Quality 16, this is a really nice, fascinating movie about early development of Alzheimer's disease and early problems that come with diagnosis. And then there's also brochures about the Edna Gates Conference that the Alzheimer's Association is involved with and we're involved with, which is another very good conference. And I think Nan's up next. Thank you very much. Oops. Thank you. And if they're gone, yell at Cassie. That's the forward and that's the pointer.
Yeah. Thanks. Hi. Boy, it's great to see so many familiar faces and get reacquainted with some old acquaintances and see so many new faces. And I don't want to say too much more because I want to move along so there's time left for questions at the end. So I just have a few slides here. And I'm going to be talking about clinical drug trials.
Could you get closer to your mic, please?
Thank you for letting me know. Is that better? Mm-hmm. All right. So this is an overview of the drug development process, and this isn't true of just Alzheimer's drugs. This is how our drugs available in this country get approved by our Food and Drug Administration. And I just want to mention this slide is Gratis, a friend, Catherine Freeman, who is works for Novartis Pharmaceuticals. She was kind enough to allow me to use this slide because it just gives a wonderful overview of what occurs as drugs come up through the pipeline. So if we start at this end, some of this is, at this end we're talking about really ideas, people in laboratories having ideas, reading about other research, finding things in animals perhaps, making observations in nature and in the test tube. So that's the discovery phase of drug development. They might find a substance or a drug that looks like, this looks like it might work in a certain way on cells that are important in a specific disease. In our instance, our interest is in Alzheimer's disease. So they do a profiling of that drug. And then they go into a preclinical phase, which is, again, mostly in laboratory setting. Clinical trial phase begins at the point that they're doing testing, transferring from animal studies into human studies. So now we're into clinical trial phase one. And phase one is generally in individuals who are healthy, not suffering from a disease. And it's usually a small sample of individuals. We want to see if the drug is safe. There might be some collection of blood samples to see how it's metabolized in the body. Those are the kinds of pieces of information collected in phase one. When we go to phase two, then we're looking at safety data. So the samples of individuals that are being studied are larger, greater number of people. In phase 2A, they're often, again, not individuals affected by a disease, but perhaps healthy individuals, but we want to see if the drug is safe to administer in people. And then in phase 2, these are individuals who are suffering from Alzheimer's disease or the disease of interest. And again, it's predominantly to learn about safety. When a drug moves on to the development in phase 3, then safety is continued to be monitored, but we're really looking to see, is it effective? Is it treating the symptoms that we want treated? Is it changing the course of the disease? Is it making people better or at the very least stay stable in their disease process? And then phase 4, phase 3, an application goes into the Food and Drug Administration if the drug looks promising, it's been proven to be relatively safe. It's proven to be relatively effective. And the developers are saying, we want the Food and Drug Administration to give us permission to manufacture this drug and sell it. So they put in an application for a new drug application to the Food and Drug Administration. Let's assume it gets approved. They've got appropriate supportive data. It goes on to phase four, which is post-marketing phase, and that's continued surveillance to make sure that the drug is indeed safe and useful and used correctly. So that's the overview of how drugs get developed. Oh, and I wanted to say one more thing about this. From around this phase down to this phase, these two large broad arrows, we're talking probably in the range of 6 to 10 years. And many, many dollars and many, many individuals helping out in the process, scientists, volunteers, big clinical program. So Dr. Giardani mentioned how exciting times are right now in the development of drugs for Alzheimer's disease, and that's because in the last 10 to 15 years, not only do we have new techniques for looking at the pathology, PET scanners, imaging of amyloid, animal models, a lot of new techniques that we did not have 20 years ago. So that's fairly recent history. And because of those developments, we have a bit better understanding of what is going on in the brains of people that have Alzheimer's disease. So this is a little bit of a complicated slide, but I just want to point out a couple of interesting features. This is supposed to be a cell, what's going on in the cell. And this is the lining of the cell membrane. And a lot of activity in cells all over your body takes place across this cell membrane, and that's demonstrated by these linkages. And in Alzheimer's disease, one of the big developments is development of amyloid plaques. So we call those the senile plaques, and that happens is a multi-step process. So across the cell membrane, there's amyloid precursor protein. There are enzymes that break down these proteins, beta amyloid, and the amyloid gets generated. When the beta amyloid gets generated, many things are taking place. It collects or aggregates into plaques. It gets attacked. Let's see, my pointer's dying here. Gets attacked by inflammation. There is excitation of the cells surrounding this collection of amyloid that can be overexcitation and actually damaging to nerve cells. There is a process called oxidation, which is the waste product of metabolism, and that can be damaging to nerve cells. And then there's a whole other pathway of development of another abnormal protein called the tau protein that collects and tangles in the brain in patients with Alzheimer's disease. So a lot of things taking place. We don't know what sets off this whole cascade. That's one of the big missing links. Why does this cascade even get started in some people's brains and not in other people's brains? We don't really know that. But we do know a lot of the individual steps that seem to be taking place that result in these collections of abnormal amounts of these proteins. So a lot of the targets for new drug development are aimed at these different steps in the process. And as I say, that's a huge advance in the last 20 years that we didn't even begin to have an understanding of before then. So one of these approaches is an immunotherapy for Alzheimer's disease that's an antibody to get rid of amyloid. So, you know, here we've learned there's too much amyloid in brains of individuals with Alzheimer's disease. Does it help to get rid of this amyloid, and can we take some of this amyloid out of the brain? So an immune therapy simply means that an antibody, is injected into the body, and then it goes to the cells that will sort of latch on, as you can see here. It binds to the amyloid. So here is a kind of a depiction of an antibody that's causing a net around this plaque of amyloid. And it latches onto it and removes it. So we know that this is happening in mice. We can do this in mice quite successfully. And this trial that is currently ongoing, and I'm just highlighting one trial. This is only one of many approaches. The previous slide showed there are many different approaches. But this is one of many that's currently being investigated. So this is currently in phase 2 and 3 trials. And these are the different pharmaceutical companies that are pursuing this type of approach to treatment of Alzheimer's disease. So you can see Elan and Wyeth, Lilly and Pfizer all have drugs that are testing this theory and this methodology. The Elan trial is in its phase three. That means, again, in humans with Alzheimer's disease. It's already completed phase two safety trials and now is looking at the effectiveness. And we are participants in the Elan Wyeth trials. We are performing the phase three trial. We were participants in the phase two trial. And I've been given permission by Elan to share some of the phase two trial data results with you. So Elan Wyeth, this is their phase two safety trial, a couple of slides about how things went. And as I mentioned, this drug is an antibody that recognizes the amyloid protein. The primary objective of this study was to evaluate the safety and tolerability in patients with mild to moderate stage Alzheimer's disease. And this took place in many centers. I believe there were about 16 centers that compared the drug administration to a placebo or sugar pill. The researchers were all blinded, so you don't know who's getting drug and who's getting placebo. Several doses of the drug were trialed. There were 234 patients. These individuals received 6 infusions. This is an intravenous infusion type of administration of this drug over 78 weeks. And again, this is just the safety data. It's a little complex slide. This whole part of the slide here are drug-treated patients, and this column here is the placebo-treated patients. And if we look at just a couple of important numbers here, we see that this is adverse events, side effects, and this is for all patients, no matter whether they received drug treatment or placebo. There were 932 adverse events reported in the 234 patients. So the average adverse event per patient was 7.5. And you can see here in the treated group, there was, and this is broken down between different, whether they were a carrier of a particular gene or not. And we won't concentrate too much on that today. But here we have 7.5 events per person who participated in the study and received drug, and 5.7 adverse events in people who received placebo. So a small difference. This was not thought to be a significantly concerning difference in terms of the number of events. This is broken down in terms of whether the adverse event was mild, moderate, or severe. So we can see it's almost identical in terms of mild adverse events in the treated group versus the placebo group. And then if you look at severity of an adverse event, meaning bad infection or a stroke, those kinds of more severe events, 6% in the treated group, 4% in the placebo group. So when we have an adverse event reported, I want to make sure people understand it isn't that we know it's due to administration of the medication. It's any adverse event that occurs to that individual while they're participating in the program. Okay. And these were the types of adverse events that got reported. And you can see there is a difference between the treatment group, this column, and the placebo group. But for the most part, these are not serious, and many of them were completely recoverable from. The one event that did not occur at all in the placebo group but was noticed in the treatment group is this edema, vasogenic edema, which is swelling in specific brain areas. 90% of these cases of edema were picked up on MRI scans, and the individuals who experienced these events had no symptoms whatsoever. So there's many safety committees, many layers of safety committee that oversee these studies, and evaluating the results of this data, the decisions were made that this is a safe drug, that these events are not overly concerning or overly abundant in the treatment group, and that this drug is worthy of continuing to study to learn whether it's effective or not. So I'll end there. The story is still continuing. We are certainly hoping to proceed and get better information about the effectiveness of this drug. There are many other drug trials. If you get on that Engage website and look up Alzheimer's disease, you'll learn of many, many other trials that are taking place both here and other places. And again, this is a contact information if you're interested in participating in drug trials at University of Michigan. So thank you for your time.
How much of the current drug research do you think would be occurring without profit motive for the drug companies, and is there a better way to do it?
I don't know that I can do that question justice. So I think there are many monitoring boards. I think that the professional academies, American Academy of Neurology, American Medical Association, have really opened their eyes to see that the monitoring of these sorts of questions needs to take place, and that drug companies need to really be ethical about these approaches and be doing them for the right reasons. And I think one of the major steps that's been taken is that any publications that get produced as a result of any of these trials must be peer-reviewed, and all of the support has to be fully disclosed. So when we as researchers or other physicians or the public read about the results of these trials, you have to be sophisticated. You have to know whether the publication is coming out in a peer-reviewed publication or not. Then read their disclosures. Are they, you know, they're required, if they are published in a peer-reviewed journal, to disclose any support that took place. And I think that's a great system. So people are opening their eyes to the fact that that question needs to be addressed, and I think it is.
And I think one of the things to remember is that it takes about $1 million, $1.2 million to actually get a drug through the regulatory process. So it is an incredibly expensive process. So that's why drug companies become more involved. That's why it gets very difficult. But if you look at what's been happening over the past few years, there have been now many more linkages between pharmaceutical industry, the government, and the Alzheimer's Association in trying to do things together in a more ethical and more appropriate manner. And I think once groups come together like that and do these studies, it's much more open and it's much more effective. But I think everybody recognizes how expensive that process is, and that's part of the difficulty with this.
That's why I asked the question. Oh, just a second, sir. Just a second. Let me come back.
Well, you've addressed the reason why I asked the question. Everybody knows it costs a lot, and maybe there's another way. I don't claim to know that we can do this without having the specter of a large profit being involved.
Well, I think one of the ways to do that are these linkages. That they're more and more trying to look at linking groups together to do them effectively and do them in a cost-effective manner. Besides the Alzheimer's centers, there is another group of universities, a larger group that includes the Alzheimer's centers, that are available, that are all sort of trained to do the same evaluations quickly so that drugs can be much faster studied and much more reliably and much more economically studied. So you're right, a lot of these things are now being addressed.
Okay, we have another question right here.
How does Alzheimer's bring about the death of an individual as it progresses if they do not have something else that takes their life prior to that?
I'm going to have you just ask the question again.
How does Alzheimer's bring about an individual's death as it progresses through its stages if something else does not take the person's life prior to that?
So the question is, what is the ultimate cause of death in individuals with Alzheimer's disease, especially if they haven't suffered from some additional medical illness that might cause their death? And unfortunately, the compromises that an Alzheimer's disease patient experiences late in the stages of their illness ultimately are going to affect their other medical functions. So, for example, their nutrition, their ability to handle excretions, so they become much more prone to infections. With a poor nutritional status, their immune system is worn down. So usually there is some intervening factor that is medically related. There can be seizures developing in late-stage Alzheimer's disease, and that can lead to serious side effects. Usually it's a combination of factors.
Okay, I have a question over here.
Thank you. Two-part question. Could you comment on the idea or status of the genetic markers for Alzheimer's and any tests that are out there as to their validity or their just the role that that might play in looking at the problem?
There are thought to be a couple different ways that we're aware of that genetics influences the risk for Alzheimer's disease. One in particular is a risk factor. So it's something called apolipoprotein E. It comes in three different flavors, and the four, apolipoprotein type 4, is a risk factor. So the problem with this is because it's a risk factor, and that's distinguished from a clear genetic cause. A risk factor is just something that if you carry it, the chances of coming down with the disease are greater. And if you have a genetic linkage or an actual causality from a gene, then you will get the disease. So for Alzheimer's disease, this APOE, which is the most commonly known, everyone can be tested for that. The problem is if we determine the results of your APOE, we can give you a percentage of what in compared to the general population, if you are a carrier versus a non-carrier, what your chance of getting Alzheimer's disease is, but we can't tell you you will or you will not. Okay, so it might be 70% or 80%. So that's the risk factor. Someone in their earlier talk, I think it was Jennifer, mentioned that there is a chance of developing Alzheimer's disease at a very young age, 30s, 40s, 50s, in those decades. And we do know that there's more of a genetic causality for most of those individuals. And there are three known genes that account for probably 50% of individuals in those age groups that have the disease. So if one has a relative who develops Alzheimer's disease in those very young decades, then there's perhaps a 50% chance that that relative and perhaps you carry the actual causality gene. And that's a whole different story than a risk factor gene. So we don't ordinarily recommend testing for the risk factors because the false negative and false positive, if you will, rates are so high that we can't really give proper guidance or helpful guidance. Whereas we might recommend, after someone's given very careful thought and had genetic counseling, the causality gene testing if someone so desires it.
Is there another question? Right here.
I'm interested in whether or not there are current or recent research studies that are dual factor and or multi-factor studies that would include human testing of drugs at the same time human testing of socialization factors, exercise and or diet together, dual studies and or multi factorial studies, and also based on news research findings just within the last couple days on a well-known cholesterol-lowering drug, whether or not there are dual studies involving genes and drugs.
You can have a second. I'll take the, okay, I'll do the first. Neil, will take the second. In terms of multi-factor studies, unfortunately, there aren't many. In this country, there are some that have been. There is recently more interest in doing that. If you go to Europe, what they do for research is they do a multifactorial study first that involves diet, education, exercise, medication, and then later on say, once we show that everybody does better or the majority of people do better, then we'll figure out what's actually causing it. In this country, we tend to start in specifics first. So we tend to say, no, we want to first look at exercise, or no, we want to look at a medication, or no. So it's very hard sometimes to get multifactorial studies done until we sort of get the little pieces done. Difficulty is with most of these risk factors and risk-lowering factors, you really have to look at a group of things at once. So now there's have been probably only over the past 2 years or 3 years in some ways has been much more interest now in saying, okay, let's look at diet and exercise. Let's look at, we have a submission now to look at a diet and exercise linked study together to try and look at the two of them together and see it, what happens when both are involved. There's a large study in France looking at diet, exercise, cognitive training, a couple of different things at once. So there are a number of different things going on like that now, but it really hasn't been a way the American researcher thinks. I guess as a quick example of that was there's a wonderful set of trials called the ACTIVE trials that were done across the United States looking at cognitive intervention, the sort of thing we can do on our own, playing games, looking at memory tasks, things like that. And they studied memory testing. They studied helping your attention. They studied helping your problem solving, and they studied helping how fast you think. So sort of this sort of set. And what they found is if I train your memory, you do better in your memory. If I train your ability to process information faster, you do that. The difficulty is if you process information faster, doesn't necessarily do anything to your memory. It sort of didn't occur to anybody to do them all at once. You know, so there wasn't a group that got everything. So now they've gone back and they're doing that, you know, that somebody's looking at all those things at the same time, that kind of multi-trial testing along with exercise and things. But actually the first government request for that research went out about a year ago. That's really the first of those, okay, we want to fund something that looks at multis. That's the issue. Sorry for the long story, but it's kind of an irritation of mine. So let me let...
I don't know if you answered my question as to whether there are dual or multi-factor studies going on the same subjects receiving any of the drugs that you mentioned that are in human drug trials at the same time other factors are coincidentally being studied.
Yep.
So to that specific question, again, the answer is no, and it's because until we... Again, I think this country and has a way of approaching research that we want to answer one question at a time. So if you put in multiple interventions simultaneously, you don't really know which one is making the difference. So right now, to my knowledge, the drug studies are kept quite separate from the other types of intervention. You did ask the other part of your question was whether there are genetic evaluations of whether people with certain genetic predisposition respond differently to the drugs. I believe that was your question. Absolutely. That is being looked at very carefully, and in fact, it's pretty clear that the genetic disposition of an individual likely influences how they will respond to a different drug.
You know, in some research now, for instance, in psychiatry and research in psychiatry that's been going on in many ways longer than research in Alzheimer's disease, there's been a lot of research on different medications that are effective, and now there's become more interest in, okay, what if we use medication, but on top of that, look at exercise, or on top of that, look at sleep effect and things. That's where, because now those medications, the psychiatric medications, are in very common use. They're disease-altering. People know they work, and now people are beginning to apply those different things. Part of our difficulty is, you know, if you think about it, this disorder has been around 100 years. People really only started to think about medications for the past 20 years, maybe at most. And we really only had five drugs that were effective over the past little while. So this is an area of research that is really brand new, and that's part of the difficulty with this. We're not where cancer research is, cardiovascular research, all those other things. It will take some time to get there.
We have one last question over here, and then we're going to have to draw it to a close.
My mother took a real serious fall and hit the side of her head where she terribly bruised herself and so forth, and her doctor told us that that fall and that that bruising bruised her brain and that that accelerated her descent into Alzheimer's. I didn't hear you say anything about that. I was watching for, and I was wondering, is that a possibility that a really serious fall could advance the Alzheimer's?
So this returns to the question of risk factors for development of Alzheimer's disease. And yes, indeed, a person who has had a serious fall with bleeding in the brain or severe blow to the brain, that group of individuals is at a higher risk for later development of Alzheimer's disease. It has been linked.
And other things as well. So it's part of the issue with these. Other risk factors come in besides Alzheimer's disease too with these. So it's a very serious head injury usually. But.
Before I thank our speakers, since there was a lot of interest about clinical research and you heard how important participants are to allowing us to move forward with research, the University of Michigan has a website devoted to clinical research on all different kinds of diseases. It's called the Engage website. You can find information at umengage.org, and there's all kinds of flyers out at the table, the Engage table. And that website also allows you to register yourself to be notified of any new studies that are coming online so that you don't have to be watching every day or week. We will tell you when something, Alzheimer's disease or any other type of disorder that may interest you, where a study matches something you're interested in. So with that, I would like to thank all four of our speakers and to thank all of you for coming this evening.
Thank you.